In 16th century Japan, an African warrior in the service of the Jesuits comes before one of the country's greatest warlords, Lord Nobunaga.
He is really impressed by Yasuke, but he doesn't quite believe that Yasuke is real. So he asks Yasuke to strip to the waist, and he looks at the skin. He says, "I don't believe that you're really black-skinned. Please scrub yourself. Is this just a trick by the Jesuits to impress me?" And, of course, Yasuke wouldn't have had any fear of his pigment being washed out.
That's Thomas Lockley. We talk with him about his book, African Samurai, The True Story of Yasuke, a legendary black warrior in feudal Japan. Then political analyst John Nichols of The Nation magazine joins us to talk about the first night in the second round of the Democratic presidential debates. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. When the African warrior Yasuke arrived in Japan in the late 1500s, he'd already traveled much of the known world. Kidnapped as a child, he'd ended up a servant and bodyguard to the head of the Jesuits in Asia. His arrival in Kyoto, however, literally caused a riot. Most Japanese people had never seen an African man before. Among those who were drawn to his presence was Lord Nobunaga, head of the most powerful clan in Japan. He was so taken with Yasuke that he made him a samurai in his court, the first foreigner ever to attain that status. Soon Yasuke was learning the traditions of Japan's martial arts and ascending to the upper echelons of Japanese society. In the 400 years since that time, Yasuke has been known in Japan largely as a legendary figure. Now, in his book, African Samurai, co-authored with Jeffrey Gerard, my guest Thomas Lockley presents the never-before-told biography of Yasuke, recounting his astonishing journey from Northeast Africa to the heights of Japanese society. In so doing, African Samurai offers a new perspective on race in world history and a vivid portrait of life in medieval Japan. Thomas Lockley is associate professor at Nihon University College of Law in Tokyo, where he teaches courses about the international and multicultural history of Japan and East Asia. Thomas Lockley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be on.
So this story, African Samurai, the true story of Yasuke, a legendary black warrior in feudal Japan, absolutely fascinating story. What got you on the trail of Yasuke's story?
Well, I've always liked history. And about 10 years ago, I just happened to see a link to Yasuke's story. I clicked on it because it seemed so unbelievable, so fantastic in a way. And his story just jumped out at me. At that point, the story wasn't very told very well. It was just a few lines, a few sources here, a few sources there. But it built up a picture in my head of an amazing, inspiring life. I didn't do very much with it for about a year after that, but it kind of played at the back of my mind. And a year afterwards, I thought, I'm going to write a book. My first book. I hadn't written hadn't really written anything before that. And I started to write a fictional book. Unfortunately, family got in the way. We had two children, you know how life works. And so that project was aborted. However, a few years down the line, when I needed to write an academic paper for a colleague who is retiring to add to his retirement journal, I thought, oh, he'd like that. I'll resurrect that topic and I'll write a little short paper about Yasuke's life just for fun. That fun turned into an awful lot of work. I hadn't realized how possible it was to actually recreate a life from so few sources. And then I found more sources as well, which made it much easier to recreate the life. And the academic paper, the word limit was 10,000 words. I was well over that. So at that point, a book came into being, and that's the book that you'll see in front of you.
It is just absolutely terrific. Now, before we get into the sources, first introduce our audience to Yasuke. Who was he?
Yasuke lived roughly from around 1555 to at least 1582, and probably a long way beyond that. We're not entirely sure exactly when he died. He was an African man. He was probably trafficked to India as a child and became a mercenary soldier there. At some point, he was employed by a Jesuit whose name was Valiano, and Valiano happened to be the chief missionary in the whole of Asia. His job was to inspect the missions, report back to Rome, and make any improvements that he saw fit. Yasuke was his bodyguard. Valiano was traveling in areas of the world which weren't necessarily safe, and he needed the best bodyguard he could find. So he employed a giant, 6'2" in those days. We would probably say at least 7 foot in today's standard. The normal people in those days were probably a lot shorter than we are today. So 6'2" looked like a giant. And Yasuke, according to the Japanese sources, at least was, well, he had the strength of 10 men. So he was not only very tall, he was huge and muscly. So he comes to Japan in 1579 with Valiano. He works with Valiano for the first 2 years in the south of Japan in Kyushu. And when it comes to Valiano's departure, he has to ask permission from the most important warlord in Japan to leave Japan. So he goes to Kyoto, the capital city, to ask permission.
So he was working with the Jesuits, obviously. He was working for the Jesuits. I want to go back to his origins for a minute. How do you know where he came from? You say basically he's a Dinke. We're very tall people. But I've also seen that he may have been from Mozambique. Nobody really knows. What were the sources that you found that led you to his origins?
So there's one source that says he was from Mozambique, which isn't modern-day Mozambique. It's the island of Mozambique, as was then a Portuguese fortress. That doesn't necessarily mean he was actually from there. He could have been trafficked from further inland. He could have been trafficked from further south or even further north. However, the people of Mozambique are quite light-skinned for Africans, and they're also quite small in stature. I don't think they'll mind me saying that, as it was the embassy official in Japan that told me that he didn't meet the description of a typical person of Mozambique, even in 400 years ago. So the Japanese descriptions of him are that he had skin as black as ink. So if you can think of the ink that comes out of a fountain pen or a very black ink pen, that was the color of his skin. In most of Africa, that would be quite unusual. So I looked, first of all, at which parts of Africa had very dark skin. What is now South Sudan was a prime candidate. And the fact that the Dinka people of South Sudan are also the tallest people on average in the whole world also added to the evidence that he might have been of the Dinka people, because he was extremely tall. Dinka people are also quite strong. They're great warriors. They're well known as, even today, they're sometimes used as mercenaries, for example. So that was my reasoning behind going for the Dinka people. Mozambique, it's a possibility, but the one source that does mention that is from 30 or 40 years afterwards and could easily be an assumption. There's no real reason to believe that it was the truth. It was a source which was in Europe. A guy who'd never left France wrote about it, so we don't really know.
So, yeah, so you deduce that, and that makes sense. Now, tell us a bit about the world of the Jesuits, of the missionaries, you know, that Valignano and Yasuke were in at the time. Give us the setting.
Okay, well, the Jesuits were a militant order, a very new order of missionaries. They'd only been in existence for less than 50 years by the time Yasuke arrived in Japan. They were mainly composed of young, passionate missionaries, or they were at least young when they left, often left Europe. they were often from military backgrounds or certainly from noble backgrounds, which in those days normally equaled some kind of military context as well. They truly believed that they were out to save the world, to save the souls of the people who had never heard the word of their God. They went about their job often violently, destroying other religions' sacred objects, stamping on other religions' beliefs, etc., etc. But they thought that they were doing the right thing. They also were very intelligent men, because they were all men, and they were also very well educated. So Valiano in particular saw that the policy of destroying native religious sites, for example, and not conforming with native cultures was not a very good policy and was not going to get very many converts. It was just going to antagonize people. So his policy was to learn local languages, to fit in with local cultures as much as possible, and to do the destruction on the sly, if you like. And he was very successful at propagating this way of doing things. Yasuke was with him during his tenure in Japan, and therefore Yasuke would have been privy to all of this and seen it. He would have also been present at important meetings with Japanese Christians to plan the future, if you like, of the Japanese mission.
And he also learned Japanese. How do you know he learned it so well?
Well, one of the Japanese sources says that he had one of the Jesuit sources said he had proficient Japanese. We also know from another source that I'm going ahead here, but the person who eventually employed him in Japan, the Lord, who is called Nobunaga, we know that Nobunaga loved talking to him and talked to him incessantly for a long time, getting his experience, getting his views of the world, and asking about all sorts of things. And for Nobunaga to have been able to do that, Yasuke's Japanese must have been pretty good.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm speaking with Thomas Lockley, co-author of a fascinating biography of Yasuke, a legendary black warrior in feudal Japan. The book is African Samurai. Now, the Jesuits, you know, they weren't just spreading religion, but they were also spreading... They were spreading the global economy, I guess you could say, including the slave trade. You talk about Yasuke being trafficked. He was a slave, but I didn't know that there were Japanese slaves as well and that the Jesuits were involved in trafficking them.
Well, they were complicit in it. They didn't do the trafficking themselves, but they were complicit in legitimizing the trade. So how it worked in those days was a slave was legitimate if they'd been taken in a holy war or a just war, and somebody needed to certify that that was the case. So if a slave's soul was going to be saved for Christ, that was acceptable to take that slave, if you like. So therefore, they were complicit within that. They weren't necessarily spreading a global economy themselves. They were just fitting into the economies that already existed and using that as a profit. To make profits, to then expand their own missions. And in Valiano's case, he justified this by saying the mission needed more money to spread the word, and therefore they would do slightly unsavory activities, including being complicit in slavery, gun running, and various other pretty nasty things to spread the word of the God.
Give us a sense of the political reality of Japan at that time and how this introduction of Catholicism played out within that reality.
Okay, so at the time that Yasuke arrives in Japan, Japan has been at war for over 100 years. So a civil war for over 100 years. So if you can imagine that the Americas, North America, the USA, had been at war since the First World War, 1919 to today, you have a fairly similar situation. So the fact of civil war comes utter destruction, the departmentalizing of the nation. So the nation has disintegrated from a fairly unified state to regional warlords, regional pirate warlords, goodness knows, whoever happens to want power in a certain region, or whoever managed to grasp power in a certain region, being their own little king in that region. So the politics at the time were that Japan wasn't really one place. It was a place of 200 little kingdoms all fighting against each other to survive, to basically continue. At Yasuke's time, we have one or two warlords taking large portions of the nation and starting to what we now think of as unifying the nation or reunifying the nation. But that obviously put more pressure on everybody else, and therefore the warfare is becoming extremely nasty at this time, even more nasty than it has been for 100 years. We have armies of 100,000 just running around with guns, shooting at each other. It was a time where war and politics were the same thing, and it was a nasty time to be alive.
And the Jesuits come into this now. Japan was then, as I guess you'd say now, you know, religiously divided between Buddhists, who had their own sects, the Shintoists, who are animists, and Christians.
There was no separation between Shintoists and Buddhists at the time. The two religions are pretty much fused into a kind of native version of Buddhism, as you can pretty much see today in many ways. There's no competition between any religions in Japan today, and there wasn't really before the Jesuits came in. When the Jesuits came in, they introduced a new and revolutionary religion, which they tried at first to pass off, or at least to kind of insinuate that it was a new form of Buddhism, if you like, that it would fit in within the native religions. They fitted in quite well at first. They were peaceful at first, but they used their leverage, which is often to do with guns, to persuade some of the lords to convert to Catholicism, or at least to pretend to convert to Catholicism. By the time Yasuke's got there, we've got about 100,000 Christians in Japan, Catholic Christians. Many of those were not personally Catholic. They'd been told by their lord that they would be Catholic, and therefore that was the situation. However, many of them were very, very sincere in their religion, and even at this point, occasionally within the wars which were raging between the traditional lords who followed the traditional religions and the lords who decided for whatever reason to be Catholic, you find that people are dying for their faith even in 1579. There's a lot more dying for their faith 30 years later, but that's at a time when Christianity becomes persecuted because it has become too powerful and it has become a real threat to the unity of the nation.
And now to Nobunaga, who you've mentioned before. What was his role in this political situation?
So Nobunaga starts out life as a tiny warlord, literally just a tiny domain. I can't think of the size, but it would be almost a speck on the map. He is an excellent general, an excellent people manager. He's also ruthless, and in many ways, we might say today, almost evil. He doesn't stop at anything to get his way. He'll kill tens of thousands to get his way. He's also the first major warlord to introduce the use of guns. So even in 1550-odd, when guns have only really been in Japan for less than 10 years, he's got 500 gunners in a professional corps, which he uses to deadly effect to destroy his enemies. By the time Yasuke's got there, he's probably got tens of thousands of gunners. We don't know the exact figures. He's perfected the arts of the volley fire. So it's literally almost like a machine gun. There's three rows of gunners. One is loading, one is firing. Then the next is loading, and they go round and round. You can keep up continuous fire. You can imagine what swordsmen and cavalrymen can do against continuous fire. Very little, nothing. They die. And Nobunaga was the expert at this, and he was starting to conquer the nation. By the time Yasuke's got there, he's probably conquered around about one-third of the country, or perhaps slightly less than that, but he's conquered the most important portion of the country, the portion with Kyoto, the capital, and many of the most economically significant cities and areas. So he's got the most important part of the country, and he's pushing out towards the sides to get the peripheral parts of the country under his control. His motto is reunify the country by force of arms. For the people of the time, they wanted peace. They wanted to be able to play with their children, to raise their crops, you know, the things that people want to do. And despite the fact that he killed tens of thousands of his enemies, everybody who was on his side loved him for that. And I have to say, Japanese people, even to today, he's one of the most popular and revered figures in Japanese history.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Thomas Lockley about his book, African Samurai, The True Story of Yasuke, a Legendary Black Warrior in Feudal Japan. So now we get to the meeting between Yasuke and Nobunaga. Actually, you have an incredible pages-long scene in the book of Yasuke's arrival in Kyoto. So even before he gets to Nobunaga, what happened?
Well, as soon as Yasuke arrives in the capital region, he is noted for his height, his difference to everybody else, and his strength. So even in one of the main ports in what is near Osaka today, people are knocking down houses, they are crushing in to see him, and the Jesuit procession finds it really difficult to leave the city of Sakai to move on to Kyoto, which is the capital. They've got people following them all the way to Kyoto, partly because they themselves, the Jesuits and their Japanese, the Japanese acolytes, are looking so fantastic. But as we hear from Jesuit sources themselves, most of the reason is because Yasuke is there, and this giant is absolutely fascinating to Japanese people. And one thing to say at this point is that the Japanese people of the time probably associated darkness or black skin with divinity. The Buddha is often described as, or even portrayed today, as black-skinned. I mean, he was an Indian originally, and Indians have darker skin than Japanese people generally. So often the Buddha is black in Japan. And also the devils, or the protectors of the shrines in Japan, are often, and shrines and temples are often black-skinned too. They're also sometimes red-skinned or blue-skinned or green-skinned as well. But the Japanese people at the time would not have seen anything approaching extremely dark skin before. So therefore, he would have been seen as a god or a devil, one of the two. Either way, something extremely divine and special. So when he gets to Kyoto, which is the capital city of about 100,000, he is mobbed. A huge crowd surrounds the church, the missionary house. They're pulling at the walls, they're throwing stones. People are dying in the crowd through the crush. They're trying to get at him. Other Jesuit crowds of the time are described as well over 10,000. So there's good reason to believe that there were between perhaps 5,000 and 15,000 people trying to get a look at him. It must have been a mad scene, and he must personally have been extremely scared for his life. Suddenly, a bunch of soldiers comes in and breaks up the crowd. Nobunaga, the lord who is in control of the region and control of most of the country at that point, has heard the crowd and demanded to hear who is breaking his peace. So he sends his soldiers, and the soldiers accompany Yasuke back to the place where Nobunaga is staying, which happens to be a temple nearby, about 5 minutes' walk from the church. And within maybe 5 to 10 minutes of being in fear of his life, Yasuke is then described as having an extremely good demeanor and being extremely polite and impressing Lord Nobunaga, a man who is not easily impressed, by the way. He is often very impatient. He gives orders which are often bizarre. Anyway, he is really impressed by Yasuke. But he doesn't quite believe that Yasuke is real. So he asks Yasuke to strip to the waist, and he looks at the skin. He says, "I don't believe that you're really black skinned. Please scrub yourself." let's find out if you're painted. Like, is it war paint or something like that? Is it makeup? Is this just a trick by the Jesuits to impress me? And of course, Yasuke wouldn't have had any fear of his pigment being washed out. And when Nobunaga found out that he's real and this is for real, he throws a big party in Yasuke's honor. He calls for his sons, he calls for his nobles, and they have a big party. And at the end of the party, Yasuke is made a rich man. He's given a huge amount of money by Nobunaga.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Thomas Lockley about African Samurai, the true story of Yasuke, a legendary black warrior in feudal Japan. And then he is given to Nobunaga by Valignano.
Given would suggest that he was Valignano's property, and Valignano did not own slaves as such. So he would, in modern day terms, we would say seconded. His services were offered to Nobunaga. Valignano was a good diplomat, a very good diplomat, and he would have seen how taken Nobunaga was by Yasuke, and he would simply have decided, all right, Nobunaga, the advantages to seconding Yasuke to Nobunaga fully outweigh any advantages that I have by keeping Yasuke in my service. So then he offers Yasuke's service to Nobunaga, correct.
But Yasuke didn't really have a choice in the matter, did he?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in those days, nobody really had a choice in the matter. We talk about freedom today as personal choice, but in those days, nobody was free as in the context that we know today. To be free in those days meant to starve, to have no patron, to have no protector. And therefore, the only people that would have been truly free to do whatever they wanted would have been people like Valignano and Nobunaga. Everybody else under them would have been bound to obey their orders, whatever happened. But to be perfectly honest with you, if I was Yasuke and I was a warrior, I was a young man, I would far rather be in service to somebody like Nobunaga than to be in service to a priest who didn't really have any need for a warrior's skills. So whether he had any choice in the matter or not, I suspect that he would have been rather happy with the situation. And the fact that he'd already been made rich by this new lord, and he had the promise of many other riches to come.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about his life with Nobunaga, and then I'll ask what happened later.
So his life with Nobunaga is described in at least three or four sources, and we know that Nobunaga, we can surmise that Nobunaga at the beginning probably thought that Yasuke would have been an adornment to his court. It'd be great to have such an exotic-looking bodyguard standing by him. We find out within a month or so that Yasuke's gone far beyond being an adornment, if you like. He has turned into a valuable confidant, almost a friend of Nobunaga. Nobunaga can't wait to talk to him, incessantly talks with him. Nobunaga gives him a house, he gives him servants, he gives him a sword, which is the mark of samurai, which is why in Japan he is held to be the first foreigner to be given that rank. He's given a salary. He's promoted essentially to Nobunaga's inner circle. That's within a month. Within the year, we know that he goes on campaign with Nobunaga once, possibly twice, and then again a third time, which is what you want to come on to later. So we know that he's gone from being perhaps an ornament to being a trusted confidant to being a warrior who fights beside his lord.
But this story has a tragic end, not necessarily for Yasuke, but certainly for Nobunaga. What happened?
Yeah. Well, the third time that Yasuke accompanies Nobunaga to battle, Nobunaga's senior general, Hideyoshi, has 30,000 men in the field already. They're fighting in the west, and he requests reinforcements. Nobunaga takes 30 of his men, his closest men, including Yasuke, and they ride for the front. Several other thousands, or perhaps tens of thousands of men, have already been mobilized, and they're going by different routes. Nobunaga's going on his own, swiftly on horseback with Yasuke and 30 others. They spend the night in a temple in Kyoto, And during that night, one of the generals who was supposed to have been marching west launches a coup d'etat. 13,000 men attack 30 men. The outcome is, of course, that almost all of those 30 men die very quickly. Nobunaga sees what's happening. He fights to the last, as far as he can go, and then he retires to a central chamber in the temple and does what every honorable samurai does in the situation. He performs seppuku. He performs a ritual suicide, which will preserve his honor. He has two people present at this. One is his lover, a man called Ranmaru, and the other is Yasuke. And Ranmaru traditionally is held to have been Nobunaga's second. Therefore, after Nobunaga has cut his belly, the second takes the head off quickly to make sure that the pain doesn't last too long. After that, Ranmaru himself cut his belly, and Yasuke is then held to have cut Ranmaru's head. Nobunaga's existing family today hold it as legend that Yasuke is the man who saves Nobunaga's head from being captured by the enemy. And why is that important? The head would have, if the head had been captured by the enemy, it would have meant that the enemy had legitimacy. They had proof that they had defeated Nobunaga. The fact that the head is removed and therefore saved from desecration by the enemy essentially means that they have far less legitimacy in the eyes of the outside world. So Yasuke's actions at this point are potentially extremely important for Japanese history. The fact that he was the one who did the saving means that it's not too far to say that he changed Japanese history.
And so how did he change Japanese history in the sense that did the clan continue then?
Okay, so Yasuke then runs to Nobunaga's son, who is in a temple about 10 minutes away, about 10 minutes walk. So if he's running, probably 5 minutes. He's taken the head. He's taken Nobunaga's sword as well, which is also a powerful symbol of legitimacy. He gives them to Nobunaga's son. But of course, there's 13,000 soldiers chasing them at this point. Nobunaga's son has 200 men under his command. They've got a strong position. But even 200 men in a strong position are not normally good enough against 13,000. Essentially, those 13,000 just mount their guns up and keep on firing until everybody's dead. Yasuke, as far as we know, is one of the few survivors. He must have been very badly injured, perhaps couldn't walk. We don't really know the situation. We do know that Nobunaga's head is never found, therefore it's likely that it was burnt. Nobunaga's son then also performs seppuku. He also suicides, and his body is also burnt. So perhaps Nobunaga's head was burnt at the same time. What happens after that is that all of the rest of the clan and the followers of the clan unite against the usurper. Potentially, if the usurper had had the head, then they might have followed him. But we never know. It's all hypothesis. But at the same time, many Japanese people would credit Yasuke with changing Japanese history at this point, or at least putting it on the course that it is on today.
And yet his trail goes cold.
His trail does go cold. Slightly after this, we have our last confirmed witness statement about Yasuke. We know that he is taken back to the Jesuit church. The Jesuits give thanks to God for his deliverance, and that's it. We know nothing else. We have lots and lots of other similar looking people that are in Japan at the time, but none of them are named as Yasuke, and therefore we can never truly say that we know that Yasuke was one of them.
I kept on thinking that this would make a great movie. Is your book going to be made into a movie?
Well, I'm not sure whether you've seen it, but it was announced about 6 weeks ago that there is going to be a Hollywood movie made, and the Black Panther actor Chadwick Boseman is going to be Yasuke. Unfortunately, the book is nothing to do with the movie. However, I think he will make a wonderful Yasuke. He's got the size, he's got the stature, he's got the demeanor, if you like, and I look forward to seeing Yasuke on the big screen.
Well, this has just been fascinating to talk with you, Thomas Lockley, about Yasuke, the first African samurai in Japan, the true story.
The first foreign samurai, first and last African. There was never another African samurai. And though there are many other foreign samurai, he is, in Japanese history, is consecrated as the first samurai who was born overseas. So he has a special place in Japanese history because of that.
Right, the first foreign samurai. Well, that's fantastic. It's just been fascinating to talk with you. And the book, I highly recommend it to my listeners. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely to be on.
Thomas Lockley is co-author with Jeffrey Gerard of African Samurai. Go to writersvoice.net for more links about the book and about the life of Yasuke. Next up, deconstructing the first of the second round of the Democratic presidential debates with John Nichols of The Nation. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. The first and the second round of the Democratic presidential debates happened last night as we produce a show this Wednesday. Much of the first half of the debate was taken up with opponents of Medicare for All going after Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, egged on by the debate moderators. Sanders wrote the Senate version of the Medicare for All bill, as he pointedly reminded Tim Ryan when the latter accused him of not knowing what Medicare for All would cover.
They will be better because Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs for senior citizens. It will finally include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
But you don't know.
Second
that.
Of all.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all.
We'll come to you in a second,
I do know when I wrote the damn bill.
My guest, John Nichols, writes about politics for The Nation magazine. He wrote a post-debate article, Last Night's Debate Produced a Clear Winner, Medicare for All. We join John Nichols from the street in Detroit, where he is stationed waiting for tonight's debate. Well, John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It is such a pleasure to be with you.
Now, the title of your piece in The Nation about last night's debate is Last Night's Debate Produced a Clear Winner, Medicare for All. Why do you think that Medicare for All won the debate?
I think it won the debate for a couple reasons. First of all, it had some tremendous defenders in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, both of whom are very effective on their feet. And I think they were far more informed and engaged than the people who were trying to trip them up. So right off the bat, they were, in a classic debating sense, very, very good at advancing the issue. But the real win was at a subtler level. Medicare for All is much discussed, but little understood, right? So you just had a 2.5-hour debate, of which probably a good third of it was devoted to this issue, where Sanders and Warren and others were able to, you know, kind of go deep and explain it. And I think that's a very, very powerful thing as regards the broader debate on the issue. So by any measure, I'd call it a win.
Now, you point out that there is a Reuters Ipsos poll from last year that found that 70% of Americans favor Medicare for All. And that has been cited a number of times, but a recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll said that, you know, when the question is a system that would, where you would have to give up your private insurance, that dropped to 41% to 54% against. Do you think that that is really about the framing of the debate?
Of course it is. Yeah. And I mean, you can frame a question any way you want. If I ask you, do you want to lose something that you've got? The likelihood is that you're going to say, no, I'd like to keep what I've got. That's logical. It's not a surprise. So when you say, you know, do you favor Medicare for All? People say, yeah, it sounds like a really good idea. I like Medicare. I like the idea of having everyone in. It's very, very popular. Then when you say, well, yeah, but what if it was going to replace private insurance? You're thinking, oh, I don't know. I got my private insurance. So this is where you have to get to the deeper discussion. You have to have, you know, some explanation where you say, for instance, that private insurance is really driven by profiteering. And as a result, if we maintain private insurance, we're going to still be moving massive amounts of money out of the economy into the pockets of some very wealthy people without providing the level of care that we want. So getting more nuanced, going deeper on this, I think is a win for Medicare for All. I think that at the end of the day, if we really have a discussion about it, people are going to say, that makes sense to me. I understand why I would get rid of my private insurance, because I'd have better quality public insurance without the profiteering. And so, of course, it's how you ask the question, but it's also how you understand what we have and what we might get to. And remember, that's very, very hard, not just for, you know, ordinary folks, but even for members of Congress. So, again, opening the debate up, getting into it, going into the finances, going into the profiteering that occurs, as Elizabeth Warren did very well last night, I think it's a huge deal.
Right. And, you know, Bernie also landed some important points. I mean, he said something that I think got lost because the moderators really shut him down on that. And that is that he said that Delaney made a lot of money in the private health care system.
Not enough to go into the chapter and verse on it. What I can tell you is that Mr. Delaney made a hell of a lot of money. He's a very wealthy man. I think he made it in a number of different areas. And I respect those who are suggesting that, like many wealthy people, you know, some of their fortune comes from the area of healthcare. The truth, though, is that's not the heart of the matter. You know, whether Delaney made money or didn't make money. Now, what's interesting is there's some people who made quite a bit of money in all this who will tell you, look, at the end of the day, they shouldn't have made as much money as they did. So you're going to get people who take lots of different stands. The problem is that we have too many people who make an assumption that replacing our current healthcare system with one that is publicly funded with a single-payer model will somehow be massively costly or more complicated or more difficult. And all of those notions are false. So whether somebody is a profiteer or whether they are simply misguided, the bottom line gets you to the same place. We have a lot of pushback against a reform that, frankly, we really need as a society.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Koch-funded study that said that Medicare for All saves the U.S. $2 trillion over 10 years. And then a UMass study, I believe by Robert Pollan, that says that Medicare for All would save the U.S. over $5 trillion in 10 years. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Look, when we start to get into the big money, you know, you're going to say, well, it's going to cost this many trillion dollars to do Medicare for All. You say, okay, that's a huge amount of money. It sounds like a lot, maybe even sounds kind of scary to get to that place. Then you say, yeah, but maintaining the current system would cost $2 trillion more, $5 trillion more, whatever number you want to get to. And that's really how we ought to do it. You know, we ought to look at the cost of the current system, what works and what doesn't work about it, and then go to that next place, go to that, you know, frankly, smarter place where we compare and contrast. You know, the weird thing about it is many of the critics of Medicare for All say, oh, we have to trust the market. We have to, you know, go with, you know, just the economic approaches that we have used in the past. But they don't really believe that. They don't want to trust the market. They don't want to look at what our choices actually are. Because if you do a deep, smart economic analysis and you look at how we would provide care for every American as a right at the point of service, you know, when you need it, you get it, without getting, you know, big copays, big deductibles, limits on catastrophic care, all these things. You know, we really provide people with the care they need. Would that cost more? Yes, for the essential care, it would. But if you take out the profiteering, which defines so much of our healthcare system now, the ultimate cost for America, for our economy, would be less. And so that's an incredible thing. You get more care for more people at less cost.
Now, there are people in between the position of the John Delaney and Bullock and Hickenlooper and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. People like, Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg, who basically say, we want Medicare for all who want it. In other words, you can keep your private insurance. They offer a public option. Weigh in on those ideas.
You know, look. That's very much part of our discourse, right? We're going to have different approaches to getting there. One of the problems of maintaining substantial amounts of private insurance is, of course, that then you end up in a situation where the most expensive cases, the most expensive circumstances, end up getting dumped into the Medicare for All system, and you don't have that sort of larger commitment to it from people who don't have as many health challenges. So this is the same debate, interestingly enough, that we dealt with Obamacare, right? Where they were, where you're talking about the public option, you're talking about things like that. And so if we understand this in a realistic way, the best way to get a less expensive, higher quality care is to have a universal system, everybody in, nobody out. That really does work best, in my opinion. Now, to get to that is very complicated because there's going to be massive pushback against it from the insurance companies, from the drug companies. It's a complicated thing. We know that, right? And it's going to be battle royale. And so if, as we move in the direction of a universal plan, there are stops along the way, as Sherrod Brown and others have proposed, for lowering the age that somebody can go into Medicare, as others have proposed for expanding Medicaid, as Kamala Harris has proposed with her plan. As you kind of move through all these things, what you have to understand is that's very much in the tradition of healthcare progress in countries around the world. In Canada, they started moving toward their Canadian healthcare system, which is very respected internationally, and which Canadians really like, and which, by the way, is producing better results than a lot of places around the world. It's a good system. But they started with that around 1944, 1945, with Tommy Douglas out in Saskatchewan. Right? It didn't happen immediately. And then it moved province by province. It eventually became a national plan. And then it eventually became better and bolder and all these other things. So I know that this is tough for folks to face because many people want to have immediate solutions, and I do. I favor Medicare for All. I want it now. But what we have to understand is that in healthcare debates, you do have steps often along the way, and I don't think we necessarily have to disregard or disrespect people who come at it from different directions. What we do have to recognize, however, is a couple of basic premises that cannot be gamed, if you will. Number one, healthcare has to be treated as a right. And once you get there, that's really vital because nobody gets turned away. Somehow or another, we make this system work. Number two, profiteering has to be addressed. Even if you allow private insurers to exist, I don't happen to think that that's the way to go. But even if you allow them to exist, you have to address their profiteering in real ways and also their frequent determination to try and knock people out of their pool if those people become, quote unquote, expensive. So when you work on those concepts, healthcare is a right, and you're going to address profiteering, I think that moves us pretty close to a classic Medicare for All program. But again, there may be steps along the way before you get all the way in.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with John Nichols, political commentator for The Nation magazine, about the first debate in the second round of the Democratic presidential debates. Now, you say healthcare is a human right. That was precisely Bernie Sanders' point when he was challenged on his position to cover undocumented immigrants in this country. I personally felt like he also should have made the public health argument on that one. In other words, we're all healthier when everybody gets health care.
Yeah, yeah.
But talk about that notion that we should cover everyone and why that's so important to Medicare for All.
Well, I mean, it's important to health care in general, right? And this doesn't, it's of course important for Medicare for All, but this gets to, as you suggest, a basic public health concept. My daughter goes to high school. In her high school, she has people from many, many different backgrounds, some of whom are multi-generational citizens of the town where we live. Their family's been there forever. Other folks who are new to town and maybe come from other states, maybe come from other countries, some of whom are immigrants and some of whom, you know, may be in a process of becoming citizens. But they're all in the same rooms. And I don't know if you know, you wear on high schools, boy, when somebody gets sick, when the flu starts moving around or something else, it really spreads pretty quick. A lot of people get sick. And if we understand it in that way, why would you want to say, yeah, we're going to provide, you know, good quality health care to some of the people there, but not the other ones? Well, under that model, you're going to have a lot of cracks in the healthcare delivery. It cracks in the service that you want. You're not going to get as good a result. So yeah, we ought to cover everybody. Of course. I mean, that's not just human decency, although I think we do it from a human decency standpoint. That's my point of view. But even if that's not your interest, it's practical. It's very practical to make sure that you address diseases, that you address healthcare challenges. And I'll tell you something else, too. Anybody who's worked in an emergency room will let you know that, you know, in the emergency rooms of this country, the people who don't have care come because they need it, obviously. They get that care because in most states you can't turn people away. And that adds enormous expense to the overall system because emergency rooms are very expensive. If we were providing care to everybody when they need it, where they need it, with a lot of public health commitment, we reduce costs. I mean, it's the tragedy of this thing. The tragedy of this thing is that we have a president and some other folks who are so determined to attack immigrants and we're so determined to use immigration issues as wedge issues that they make it seem like denying care to an immigrant family somehow, you know, puts them outside the system, means that they don't cost anything. That's not true. They're still here and they still will need care when they need care. And so from, again, a human standpoint, I say they should get it. And also from a practical standpoint, I say they should get it because, frankly, again, it will cost us less.
Yeah, practical. You know, let's say pragmatic. Let's use that.
Pragmatic is another way of saying it, yes.
Which is so often a term that is appropriated by those who would deny that kind of care. Now, I wanted to ask you, you know, this, the first debate was advance build as a Bernie versus Warren debate. But they seem to be much more like a team than rivals. I wonder if you could weigh in on that. And what did that do for the debate? How did that change the character?
That's such a good question, such a wise question. It changed everything about the dynamic of the debate. Because when you had two people reinforcing a basic concept, even though the moderators and a number of the other candidates were, you know, kind of in a poorly defined way trying to undermine them. You know, they're basically saying, yeah, but this is a bad idea, or this is going to be unpopular politically, or this is costly, or whatever. You know, throwing everything they could at it. If you've got one person defending, that can still work if the person's very able. In fact, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are quite able. But boy, if you've got two of them, it changes the dynamic. And in my opinion, it created a circumstance where you had a legitimizing of these arguments. Elizabeth Warren said to the Democratic candidates who were suggesting that a single-payer plan would be unpopular, when in fact it has a lot of potential to be very popular, that they shouldn't go down the line of using Republican talking points. And then a few minutes later, Bernie Sanders said to Jake Tapper, you know, your question's rooted in Republican talking points. When both of them do that, right, suddenly that term gets resonance and it has power in the debate beyond what would happen if just one person was doing it. And so I think the dynamic, which I had not fully expected to develop in this way, I did not think they were going to go at each other. I didn't, you know, I've covered these two people for a long time. It's not their nature. I wouldn't have expected it. But that they actually became kind of almost a tag team on behalf of Medicare for All was really a fascinating dynamic. And I think it changed the tenor of the debate. I think it made a debate where Medicare for All was a as I suggest in the piece I wrote, a winner. You know, it was it came out of it stronger and with more resonance. And it'll be interesting tonight. Well, we're talking on Wednesday morning before the Wednesday night debate. It will be interesting to see how some of this translates into the debate with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and others, because it is unlikely that on that stage you're going to have somebody who is as effective as Sanders and Warren were. But it would be very interesting to see if one of the candidates who's perhaps not polling as well decides to step up and really argue the case for single payer. I would think perhaps a Bill de Blasio or someone like that, or Kirsten Gillibrand, who's been on some of these issues, signed on to the Sanders bill. That could be fascinating because it could create a whole new dynamic. And in that case, you're going to have Biden in one place, a more cautious and more moderate or centrist place. Harris there with her position, and then maybe somebody else kind of a little closer to the Sanders Warren position. And we could well end up with two nights of debates that really expand out the discussion of Medicare for All. Fascinating. This is actually, I'm usually a critic of debates. I usually see ways that they just don't work. In this case, I'm frankly kind of impressed.
I'm looking forward to it as well. And John Nichols, your article for The Nation is Last Night's Debate Produced a Clear Winner, Medicare for All. We'll link to that as well as your subsequent analysis of tonight's debate. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's a complete honor to be with you. Thanks for such good questions.
John Nichols of The Nation magazine speaking to us from the streets of Detroit. And we will link to his articles about the debates at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.